Tonight on Arena, in TV, Blue Lights, Feud and The Jinx all move into their second seasons, and Mick O'D on his Casey-inspired What is the Stars? Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. That's Mick O'D, by the way, on his O'Casey-inspired exhibition, What is the Stars? We'll be talking to Mick a little bit later on. But we are starting this evening with, or in the world of televisions, and as I say, second season is very much to the fore. Feud. This is Feud, Capote versus the Swans, latest offering from Disney, directed by Gus Van Sant, with Tom Hollander playing Truman Capote. It's the story of how a group of society ladies in 1950s America befriend the writer, invite him into their inner circle, but when he betrays their trust, they set out to exact revenge. Blue Lights, the Northern Irish police drama, returns to BBC One for its second season, created by Adam Patterson and Declan Lunn. Spoke to Declan Lunn on the programme last week. This follows a group of police officers in modern-day Belfast. Frontline response police come under unique pressures and dangers in that part of the world. And finally, almost a decade after the release of the Emmy Award-winning documentary miniseries The Jinx, The Life and Death of Robert Durst, Andrew Jarecki, the director of the series, returns with The Jinx Part 2, a sequel series exploring and uncovering even more about the late convicted killer's life and investigations into the murders he committed. Arlene Hunt, with me in studio here in Dublin. Mary McGill joins us from Galway. We'll start with Feud, Capote versus the Swans. This is another an anthology series, Arlene. We got Bette Davis and Joan Crawford in Feud Series 1. Capote versus the Swans. We are in a very interesting milieu, very wealthy.
This is the upper stratosphere.
Yeah, the top end of the upper stratosphere.
Yeah, yeah. The very top end of New York social scenes.
In the 50s.
It's the late 60s, early 70s. Yeah. It's after Capote has
His success.
His success with Breakfast at Tiffany's and In Cold Blood, which was huge. It really made Capote.
Which was the story of the family who were murdered out.
Yeah, the farm in farmland, the family that were killed.
In the Midwest, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and he went down and he interviewed them and he became close to one of the killers and then subsequently wrote his book. Writing books can be a good thing for Capote, and it can also be a devastating endeavour for this strange little man.
Yeah, not only that, writing books, if you're one of Capote's friends, can be very interesting, but it also can be a devastating business for you, I would hazard to say, Mary McGill, because that's precisely, Mary, what happens in this series. He has befriended, as I say, he's really well linked into this group of very wealthy American women, married to very many wealthy American men. But when he needs material, he doesn't care where he goes for it.
No, he doesn't, Sean. And Feud opens spectacularly with this very juicy, gossipy scene between himself and the queen of New York social life at this stage, called Babe Paley, played by Naomi Watts. And she is confiding in him this, shall we say, very messy scene that she has walked in on with her husband, a very powerful man who has set up CBS in America, one of the big broadcasting networks, and his mistress, who is, I think, a Hearst. So that will give you an idea of the milieu that we're dealing with here. And of course, Truman is lapping this up and he's giving, you know, Babe advice and so on and so forth. But Truman, he's had huge success within Cold Blood, and he needs to produce another book. He has gotten a big juicy, I love that word tonight for this particular show, but he's gotten a big advance from Random House, which he has not honoured. He's gotten another advance. He's missed more and more deadlines. So as his friendship with these women is deepening, his need to produce new work is also deepening, as is his drug addiction and his problem with alcohol. So all of these events are coming together and they're producing a moment in this series, which is him producing his new work that is actually a thinly veiled account of all of the gossip that he has received from his dear friends, these glamorous women.
Yeah, and this was what would become Answered Prayers.
Exactly. And you know, it's so in your face. Like Answered Prayers doesn't really come out as a novel in the US, but it is excerpted in Esquire magazine in 1975.
Yeah.
The name of the piece is Le Cote Basque, 1965. And this is the restaurant where they all used to get together. So it's very sharply done. He is very cruel in the way he administers this tell-all.
All right. Well, let's listen to a scene from the said restaurant where he is at lunch, and he's brought along with him a young fellow who he's met in a sauna.
John O'Shea,
played by Russell Tovey. So he's there at this lunch with him, and Tom Hollander plays Truman Capote, and the swans here are Babe Paley, Naomi Watts, Diane Lane, Callista Flockhart, and Chloe Sevigny. What a cast that is of swans. And then in the midst of all of this is Demi Moore playing Anne Woodward, who is a woman that he has written about in this excerpt that has been seen, or that he has written about previously, and kind of said that she murdered her husband effectively. So not surprising that she is a little bit upset about all of that. Let me just bring it up to, there we go. Let's have a listen to that clip.
You think I don't know? Like, I know what you're saying about me. Bang, bang.
Anne, you really don't want to do this. Whatever you're doing, just don't do it public, dear. Go sit down.
You're telling people that I murdered my poor late husband? That's slander and libel. And you're telling people it's in your new book?
Well, if it were not true, it would be libel, Anne, but it is true. And we all know it. And it will be a very interesting chapter.
I don't know why you started this. I mean, we were close. Just tell me why. Let me go, Slim. No, he's, I mean, it's torture. I hear it everywhere. I don't even know how you can be sitting here with him. Just tell me why, Truman.
And there we have. It's mostly Demi Moore we hear in the midst of that, obviously, with talking to Tom Hollander as Truman Capote. And I was debating a little bit with you, Arlene Hunt, about the nature of Tom Hollander's performance here. I can't get past Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Do you know what it is, though? This is later in Capote's life.
All right.
Earlier in Capote's life, I don't think he was as camp. I don't think he was as drawn out. I don't think he had the same alcohol problems that he has.
So
in
that
the
could
era
be.
That we're seeing him now, he certainly didn't have the drug problems he had. He didn't have John O'Shea and that whole mixed up, messy, sexual.
Yeah, because I suppose the Capote film dealt with the period in and around In Cold Blood, really. And that was what
when
it was
he was really
with.
At the height of his powers, you know, and he took things very seriously back then. So I don't think he was the same Capote that we are seeing now.
Yeah, and that's now when I think about that, that makes a lot of sense. And for you, Mary, first of all, Tom Hollander is Truman Capote, but that group of swans around him, I mean, they are phenomenal high power actors, all four or five of them, if you include Demi Moore.
Yeah, we've got Diane Lane as Sim Keith. I mean, Callista Flockhart as Lee Rosible, who people will probably know on this side of the Atlantic as Jackie O's younger sister. I mean, the cast alone, Sean, you mentioned there about, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman. I was blown, and that's immediately who I thought of, and I was like, oh, they're going to go with Capote, okay. Tom Hollander, I mean, he disappears into this role. Like, I was looking at footage from Truman at this point in his life, at his famous black and white ball, you know. And what Hollander does is, I actually struggle to see him as a person within this character. He is utterly absorbed into this Capote who is so far from the golden boy of American letters that he had been. I mean, this is what it actually reminded me of is another piece of Ryan Murphy work on Andy Warhol, the Andy Warhol Diaries. It's on Netflix, but it looks at similar themes, this idea of an aging artist still struggling to try and get recognition, deeply insecure, surrounding themselves with glamorous people in New York, and ultimately at the end of their lives, not being able to enjoy what they have produced. Like they've left this incredible legacy, and yet them as a human being, there's just some insatiable need that they are just drawn to this kind of self-destruction, which is what, you know, ultimately Truman Capote does in this story. You know, he could have written another book, he could have traded on his achievements, he could have kept his friends, but for some reason there's something about these swans, and it may well be because they remind him of his glamorous mother figure played by Jessica Lange, who rejected him and neglected him as a child, but for some reason he feels the need to hit the self-destruct button on these relationships.
I only got to see the first episode of this, but I was totally hooked in. As the series progresses, I presume he falls apart further and further, and then they exact their revenge.
He does, but it's an interesting thing to say exact revenge on him, because what mostly they were was hurt. They were super hurt by what he did because it's interesting. This show isn't just about him. It's about the women. It's very much about the women. These are high-powered women. They're fated for their beauty. They're stunners. They're socialites. They're from very, very wealthy families. But almost all of them have been, to some degree, abused by the men that they chose in their lives. Alcohol, anorexia. They all smoke heavily. These are not...
And huge pressure on
them to perform and to be the perfect person. So for them... Their little club, their lunches together, that was their moment, their moment to let the guard down. And they invited him in. They invited a male into their space. They invited him in particular because, as one point Babe says, you know, loyalty was so important to her. And the fact that he took their inner sanctum and made it public it was the most massive betrayal of all time. I mean, it was the most hurtful thing he could have possibly... It was so cruel what he did to them.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so, as when they shut, when they close rank and he's forced out, it was self-destruction.
Yeah, he kind of did it upon himself. You enjoyed this, Arlene?
I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was really, really captivating. I thought the fashions were incredible. I thought the actors were incredible. I would agree that he disappeared into the role himself. You know, it's a mesmerizing performance.
Stars?
Oh, I'm giving it 5 out of 5. I love it.
4 out of 5. Well, for you, Mary, you'll be sticking with it if you haven't already got through to the end. I'm not sure.
The source material is so rich. The only thing I would say narratively is that I think maybe because the betrayal is so spectacular, that maybe it comes a bit too early. Maybe they could have used that as kind of to give the narrative more puff to build to it. But I mean, visually, acting wise, Brian Murphy is the king of campy kinds of drama. There's a lot to be enjoyed here. So I'm going to say 3.5. Stars.
3.5 from you. All right, that's Feud, Capote versus the Swans, out today. In fact, start watching it tonight if you want on Disney. Let us move on then to Blue Lights. Season 2 of the Northern Irish police drama on BBC One follows 3 police officers in modern day Belfast, a city where obviously frontline policing is a whole different ballgame than in many other cities. Mary, we spoke to the writer, one of the writers on the programme on last week. And in fact, Dan Lawn, his name's gone out of my head. Lawn is his second name. I can't remember.
Declan Lawn.
Declan Lawn, thank you very much. Declan Lawn, who was on the programme with us last week. This series, Mary, do you need to know much about season one going into season two?
I knew absolutely nothing, Sean, because I haven't seen series one. So I can say you absolutely do not. You do not. This had me within the first 60 seconds. I am so impressed by Blue Lights. And I found myself, when I heard we were going to be looking at this, I said, another police procedural. Because let's face it, it's one of those genres, there's no end to them. And I think if you're going to produce another one, it needs to do something differently. And I think what Blue Lights does is it's setting, it's its placing in Belfast. And my hat's off to Declan Lawn and Adam Patterson on their writing. It is top notch, because what we get is this very complex post-conflict society that is the lens through which this police procedural plays out. But it never feels like a lecture. It never feels like less than anything that is authentic and complex and deeply representative of this idea of a post-conflict society, which is far more complex than is often given credit for. And in this mix, in series two, we have, you know, these rookies who were starting out in series one, Grace played by Sian Brooke, Annie played by Catherine Devon, and Tommy played by Nathan Braniff, and they've had their edges knocked off. And I won't give too much away about the ending of series one, but it didn't go. They had a mentor that they lost, and it's been very difficult for them.
That loss, and we won't go into the specifics of it, because by the way, season one, if you haven't seen it, is still available on the RTE player. And as well, I've started dipping by. I'm trying to watch the two at the same time, which is quite a task, I can tell you. But at any rate, season one still is there on the RTE player, and a very important character is lost towards the end of it. Let's not go no further than that. Mm-hmm. But what we get here, Arlene, it's not just the kind of the police procedural side of things. We really get into the personal lives and the interrelationships in the police station itself, and there's great chemistry and great mileage in that.
It's amazing how, it's not a long show, but it's amazing how much character development there is within such a short framework. You know, you've got Annie, who is a bit of a firebrand and a bit of a you know, she really just says everything she's thinking.
This
she's,
is the Catherine Devlin character.
Yes,
yeah.
And she has a new partner now, Shane, who's been sort of handpicked by CID to
and
go
who
on.
Appears first in his
oh, he's not wearing his top
off.
Yeah. But there's a, like, the sexual tension between her and him is almost immediate. They're like they're like two little magnets going, yeah, yeah. And they go around in the car together. But there's an interesting one of the scenes, and I'm not going to give a lot away about the series, but in the opening series, you know, there's a scene where they have to go to a pharmacy, and the point of what's happening in the background of this is there's an increase in the drug trade, a sudden spike,
yes.
And it's the ground force guys have to find out what the heck is going on, because obviously things are happening on the street. There's been overdoses, people are dying, there's been an increased aggression. And CID and the task force are looking into the behind the scenes, but it's the people on the front line who have to deal with the day-to-day problems, and they are called away to an incident in a pharmacy. And it's interesting to watch the dynamic between Annie and Shane, how they handle a situation, because she's impetuous, because she's still a rookie.
Yeah.
It was only a year since what happened in the first series, so she's still quite rookie, she's still quite young, quite, you know, and she makes a decision that even as she made the decision, I felt, oh no, this is going to come back and haunt you. And I was right. But then it adds to the whole tension between her and Jane. It's great fun.
And the background, in the background, there's also this essentially loyalist drug gangs in the background of it all, Mary, which adds huge tension in terms of the dynamics across the whole community there. Because season one effectively dealt with the Republican community.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, when one crime syndicate takes a backseat, another one is only too happy to step into the breach. And this time it's from a loyalist perspective. But yes, absolutely. So we have, you know, a lot of action centred around a loyalist estate called Mount Eden, where there is this escalating feud, but it's also where they suspect a lot of this drug trade is originating from. And in the middle of all of this are ordinary people, as ever, trying to live their lives. So we've got Lee Thompson, played by Seamus O'Hara, who is a proud unionist, and his sister Mags, played by Shana Kirstake.
Shana Kirstake, yeah.
Yes, and they are running a pub. He's also driving a taxi. And it doesn't help that he has to pay basically protection money to these local loyalist thugs. So again, this idea of a post-conflict society, what does that meaningfully look like in operation?
The other thing, the other aspect, so that loyalist drug feud is one thing, the personal relationships within the station is another, but there's also a case from way back in the 1970s during
That's
the
right.
Troubles. Let's listen to a clip which talks about that. This is Happy Kelly, played by Paddy Jenkins, and he's talking to Jen Robinson, who's now a solicitor. She did work in the station in season one, that he has real regrets about his own behaviour.
I get people hurt, Jen.
Happy. Stop it.
I do, Jen. I get people hurt. My daddy, my brother, and then all them years later, Jerry. The bomb. That night in 1978, it was my idea to go for chips. I said to my daddy, it's Friday, can we go for chips? It was my idea. One day of void.
Did they ever convict anyone for the bomb?
Looked into it a few years back, made a report.
What kind of report?
Into unsolved cases. Nothing ever came of it. Nobody would talk. That's the thing about this place, Jen. Even after all these years, people think the truth is dangerous. Maybe they're right.
Even after all these years, people think the truth is dangerous. That's Paddy Kelly played, Paddy Jenkins rather, playing the character of Happy Kelly, and Hannah McLean playing the character of Jen Robinson in Blue Lights season two. We were saying as we listened to that, Arlene, there are so many strands in this series, but they managed to keep it. You don't get confused at all. It's perfectly paced.
It's perfectly paced, and the strands are not interwoven just yet, but you can feel where they're going to, everything is going to crisscross, and it's going to be a tight weave. It's just this poor man, you know, even listening to that clip, you know, he's so broken about the past and he's so damaged by the past. It's you know, he carries his guilt, like it's right on his face. It's great. But that conversation they have she's going to go back into cold cases, stuff that maybe should be left alone. I don't know. But this is where we're going. And
certainly in a drama, we know that it's going to cause
drama,
trouble. Whatever about
alone.
Real life, it's a different scenario there. Overall from you on this one, Mary, I mean, I was totally hooked after about 40 seconds of episode one of season two. And as I say, I'm now watching both seasons in tandem, which is quite the experience. How are you getting on with it?
Oh, it's a solid 4 out of 5 for me. I think that line that Happy just said there about the truth and how immediately Jen comes up against a kind of a stonewalling that's like, oh, this stuff is in the past. We just need to forget about it now. I think that you know, again, this ability that Blue Lights has to be funny and engaging, great characters, but also to really dig into what is such a complex situation in Belfast. Yeah, great show. Great show.
Right. Stars from you, Mary.
At 4 out of 5.
Four. What are you saying overall here? On
Same
Stars?
4 out of 5. I really enjoyed. I didn't see the first series, but I'm going to make it my business to go back and see see the first now.
On the player, on the RTE player, as I said, Blue Lights season 2. The first episode aired on Monday on BBC One, on BBC, and then it's every Monday for the next 7 weeks, I guess. But that will appear, I'm sure, on RTE at some point along the way. But you could do worse than watch season 1 if you haven't seen it to prepare yourself for season 2. Now let us move on to our final one for this evening, which is a true life tale, The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. I mean, The Jinx itself, Arlene, the original
2015. Yeah. Oh my God, the water cooler moment.
Yeah, at 10 years almost ago at this age. This was a defining moment in terms of true life drama,
this
or true
incredible.
Crime drama.
This is incredible. This is about an obscenely wealthy real estate mogul called Robert Durst, who sat down in 2013 is when he sat down to talk to a director named Andrew Jarecki to speak about, he'd been caught, he had dismembered his neighbour, this poor man called Morris, I think it's Morris Black was his name.
I think you're right, yes.
And he had been caught for it and he had gone to court and been exonerated. He was acquitted.
Yeah.
Maybe exonerated is the wrong word. He was acquitted. And so he sat down to have a conversation with this man and about his life. And it turns out that his wife has been missing since 1982. And so too, and his best friend, Susan Bergman, was murdered in 1982. Within 1982. Yeah. And so, he sat down to chat with them. There was six episodes over the series, and in the last episode he revealed something very powerful about himself.
Yeah, and in fact, as had happened, and I don't think we're giving any spoilers away here because it's so long ago and it was all over the news at the time, Mary, he was arrested before the broadcast of the final episode in season one.
Yes, it gives a whole new meaning to the word hot mic moment, I will say. I had not seen the first episode or the first series my jaw was on the floor. So many true crime formats, dramas, call them whatever you will, make a nod to they're doing what they're doing to kind of bring justice to the situation, often because they know what the material they're dealing with is quite prurient and their role in it is all a bit grubby. Here we have a situation where a documentary team have actually paved the way for justice for the victims of Robert Durst. I just was blown away. I was blown away by him as someone who had, from his earliest years, even as a child, displayed symptoms of some kind of personality disorder. Something wasn't right. His treatment of his first wife, who disappeared in suspicious circumstances, was very troubling, but the authorities couldn't get him because there was no body. There still is no body. And we have the very strange death of his friend, Susan Berman, and we have his neighbour, Morris Black, who he literally, you know, admitted to dismembering. And every step of the way, he got away with it. But in series 2, we are now dealing with a Bob, as he likes to call himself, who is in jail, who is going to have to face up to everything that he's done. But I think what series 2 it kind of pans out a bit and it goes, how did he get away with this for so long? And central to that are kind of looking at people who, for very kind of weak and self-serving reasons, enabled him to get away with it for as long as he did. It is just, honestly, you could not write drama like this. You couldn't make it up.
Stranger than fiction, as they say, the truth
always
is. Let's have a listen to a clip featuring Charles Bagley, a New York Times journalist who spoke to Durst after each episode of season one. But here he's just talking about how Durst could call on his old friends after he was arrested.
From the moment Bob was arrested in New Orleans, he was reaching out to old friends, looking to see who can he rely on. He was seeking both emotional support and to see who would be on his side.
Hey, dog.
Hey, how you doing? Hello, Bobby.
Hi, Sue. Susie?
How are you?
The people around Bob helped him, whether it was consciously or unconsciously, go on for so many years without consequence.
And I wanted you to know, I would have taken care of anything you needed taken care of. You know that.
I know that.
I like to think that if a good friend of mine is suddenly implicated in 1, 2, 3 murders, that I would recoil from that. But who knows until you're tested.
That's Charles Bagley, the New York Times journalist, in a scene from The Jinx season 2. And Arlene, we were talking about the fact one of the people that befriended Durst after his acquittal in the murder trial of Maurice Black was one of the jurors.
That's right.
He seemed to just have this charisma that, well, maybe it's money that he has. He could, anybody would do anything for him.
That's Chris Lovell and his wife Donna. Donna became the assistant to Bob Durst, Bob Duvall was her husband and a great friend of Durst's as well, which developed after the trial. But I mean, he's surrounded by a cast of lunatics, is basically, and they operated like the mafia. As long as the money is coming in and they're getting their slice of the pie, they don't really care. There's nothing about these people that it has
any sort
of moral compass whatsoever. And there's a huge cast. There's a guy here called Nick Chinga Chavin, who could only be an American. He's a real estate developer, a country and western porn singer.
I don't know if that's a specific type of porn singer, but anyway, let's go on.
He's a country and western porn. That's what he is. That's his part-time
job.
But he's a really interesting character because he was a friend of Katie, who was Bob Durst's first wife. He was a good friend of Susan Bergman.
Right.
And he knew that it was most likely that Bob had killed both of those women, and he didn't really mind because he liked Bob. And it wasn't, he didn't feel suitably motivated to maybe talk to the police about him until his second wife sort of gave him a guilt trip about it. That's what you're dealing with.
You two, I have to say, I have had a great week at the television. Mm-hmm. And I must admit, I had three. I'm absolutely hooked on all three of these items that we've dealt with this evening. Stars from you, Arlene, on The Jinx Part 2.
I'm actually just going to go ahead and give it a 5 because I find this entire concept of this show fascinating.
Right.
And the more I learn about this man, the more horrified I am to.
And from you, Mary?
Yeah, it's a good 4 from me. I mean, my jaw was on the floor. I hadn't heard about The Jinx. I was like, what is The Jinx? And I mean, there's a scene, if you haven't watched the first episode, there is a scene in the first series of the second, or the first, if you haven't watched the first series, the first episode of the series 2, there is a scene in that will literally, it's like nothing I have ever seen before.
Yeah,
it's a piece of filmmaking that just goes spectacularly well.
It's extraordinary stuff. Yeah,
yes.
People watching season 1.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, listen, very solid from both of you there on The Jinx Part 2, set to premiere on Sky Documentaries. That's next Monday the 22nd. For Capote versus the Swans, out today on Disney, and Blue Lights Season 2 airing on Monday evenings on BBC. Arlene Hunt and Mary McGill, thank you. Artist Mick O'Dea is showcasing his latest work in an exhibition called What is the Stars? It consists of 24 paintings presented by Druid Theatre in conjunction with their production of Sean O'Casey's Dublin Trilogy. Mick served as artist in residence for Druid O'Casey, attended rehearsals and performances throughout 2023 in both Galway and Dublin. He had unprecedented access to a production of this scale. Paintings capture the behind-the-scenes activity of a theatre company that audience just rarely witness. Delighted that Mick O'Dea was in the studio with me this evening. And I remember actually, Mick, we were down there ourselves, the programme, we went down to Galway, or over to Galway, I suppose would be the way of saying it. And we're going to tweet a link to our own Druid Murphy special, which was on July the 27th of 2023. 23. We were discussing O'Casey's trilogy, The Plough and the Stars, Shadow of a Gunman and Juno and the Peacock, with lots of the cast and through its artistic director, Gary Hines, there. And that was an amazing, we felt, access to get. We were on the set. We'd seen all three productions, and to have them, to be able to talk through it with them in that fashion was quite extraordinary. But you were there the whole time. This was... You were embedded. You were an embedded journalist, embedded painter.
Yes. Loitering with intent, I guess, you know, Sean. And what a privilege. I guess one of the privileges of being an artist is that, and particularly a portrait painter or people, or somebody who works representationally, is that I occasionally get asked to do something like this, which turns out for me to be an extraordinary experience just to get behind the scenes. Mm. I think I was saying to someone, the reason why I wanted to be an altar boy, or I became an altar boy at one stage, was just to see what the hell happened in behind when they all disappeared into the sacristy afterwards. I found that out. But to also have the opportunity to get in behind to see what the actors do and to be part of the process is something that I never had the opportunity to do before. And to sit in the digital hub on Thomas Street, to look at the first readings, to witness the characters being fleshed out by the actors in discussion with the director and with the costume, the wardrobe department, and then the stage design, the lights. It was quite a privilege. Yeah. And at that early stage, it was mainly sketches in notebooks and turning up whenever I had the chance. And I asked Gary, like, what area should I keep away from, or could I have access to all areas within reason? She said, access to all areas within reason. So that was like a total gift.
So the only time you were not to be somewhere was when there was a safety issue. They're hanging a light here, don't stand underneath.
Yeah, or if I was getting in the way, like a big stupid Egypt, which can happen occasionally, you know.
Yeah, we're going to tweet as well. We've put up that link to our own Irina Druid Murphy special, but we're also going to tweet images, various images from the exhibition as we're going along here as well. And I could pick any one of them. What I love is how you capture those moments backstage, you know, actors getting ready to go on. I think most of these are during the dress rehearsal, you were telling me. I'm looking at one of Katrina Ennis, just simply called Backstage. Katrina Ennis, I presume this was for The Shadow of a Gunman, I'm guessing, yeah.
Yes.
She's standing backstage ready to go.
No, that actually, I think, might have been, that was not The Plough and the Stars. Was it The Plough and the Stars? It was Juno and the Peacock.
Juno. So she's standing getting ready to go on, and we can look in and we can see other people actually on stage, and we can see the back of the flats.
Yes.
You know, as in the flats that you don't see from the front. You see the set itself.
Yes.
But we see the woodwork and all of that. Mm. But these look as if they're, you know, you got the people to stand there for a half the day while you were painting them.
Well, the great secret of a lot of those paintings was the iPhone camera. So that by the time it came to being on the set, being at the back of the set, back of the stage, there was no way that I could have had people stand or pause like that.
Because they were in the middle of a dress rehearsal, they couldn't stop to get their picture
taken. For sure. So I used the iPhone a lot, took lots of photographs and worked from them then in my studio in North Mayo. And which was a peculiar sensation in its own way, feeling that I was in the middle of a Dublin tenement and also in the middle of all these amazing rehearsals which were happening in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. So, that was the secret, Sean, but also obviously interpreting those, chopping them where I needed to and, taking license myself with the theatricality and with the drama and the lighting, you know.
For example, there's another one of a curtain call, and this one we just see five characters standing looking out into the empty house because it was a dress rehearsal. But that's a very interesting view that we don't often get, the backs of the actors looking out at the audience, which is a great view if you're the actor doing it.
I know.
But seeing their backs is a wonderful view in itself.
And also kind of just the whole sensation of looking out there into the abyss. You know, I'm so full of admiration for the risks that actors take. They're up there literally on the stage. They're looking out. You don't know what the response is going to be. So that for me, in this series of paintings, I'm not so much concerned with the drama that was occurring on stage that the audience experienced. Rather, for me, the drama was backstage before the actors went on to act, where they were contemplating, you know, where...
Just getting ready. There's a lovely
that space in between.
Yeah, Marty Ray in one of the plays as well, just with his head down, you can see him just gathering his thoughts before he makes his entrance onto the stage. You also have paintings that features one of Gary Hines up on stage directing. There's one of Francis O'Connor, the set designer, is standing there as well. There's another one of, I can only see the man's back.
Connor Linehan.
It was Connor was looking out the doors. So it was Connor was there.
Oh, no, that was the...
One of the stagehands,
I would
guess.
Yeah, he's the actual... he was the... his name eludes me at the moment. He was the lighting director. Yeah.
So and we're just looking at him, obviously getting the light focused for when the door opens.
Exactly. And that, of course, then these moments also are kind of pregnant with meaning. Yeah. You know, they can be interpreted in any way, you know.
And that's those days when they're getting those things ready, nothing is happening for an awful long time. Then suddenly everything clicks into place, a bit like a film set. And people are rehearsing on it.
Yes.
But I guess this period and the period that's covered by the three plays in the trilogy, it's that point in time from just before the War of Independence and through the Civil War. That's the period that the three plays cover here.
Yes.
Huge interest to you in everything that you've been doing really in recent times, isn't it?
It is. And that's the reason why Gary asked me if I'd be interested in being the artist in residence for this particular series. She said very generously in the introduction to the book stroke catalogue that we have for the exhibition that the images that I produced informed to an extent, gave flesh to the way she imagined that it might be. She liked that series I did. I did a trilogy myself between 2010 and 2014 of exhibitions on the Black and Tans, War of Independence and Civil War. Subsequently, I did one on the War of Independence. But I guess I got a lot of experience, a huge interest in that period. And I was particularly, as a painter, sometimes you marvel at the surface. And my notion is that if you are diligent enough at looking at the surface, something of what lies beneath might reveal itself. So I don't go to get underneath the skin immediately. I examine what's on the surface. And of course, one of the things that is obviously on the surface from that period and also for costume dramas are the costumes. And then that reveals so much about people as well, the way they what they dress, how they present themselves. And I was fascinated by that. And then the kind of details that and the knowledge that I got from looking at a lot of photographs from that period, then I guess informed me about how I would approach the trilogy of plays by O'Casey. And it's exactly that time. And also, I guess, my studio. I've been living in a former tenement, not living in it, but rather working in one in Henrietta Street for the last 40 years, which is all coming to an end for some of the artists now. There we're finishing up there in July. So, but we're very familiar. I was very familiar with the actual places.
And finally, then, having done the trilogy in this fashion, will that feed back in, do you think, into the work you'll do on this period, or will you move on from this period to some other period now? What's the plan?
Oh, I'm very fickle. I'm not sure. I kind of I get bodies of work together, I get ideas and opportunities present themselves, I think. I don't know what the next opportunity is, but in between the engagement that I had with Druid and this exhibition, I also spent a period of time in Tanzania doing portraits of women activists who are fighting particularly female genital mutilation. And that series of paintings I've yet to show, and they were done in front of a live audience in Tanzania by supporters of the women that I have
painted. Certainly is an interesting subject indeed. Well, thanks for coming into us this evening, Mick. And What Is the Stars, the exhibition we've been speaking about by Mick O'Dea, is at the Molesworth Gallery. It's there from this Friday, 19th of April, runs through until the 15th of May, and you can find out full details on Molesworth Gallery .com or druid.ie. What Remains the Same is the third collection from Alvy Carraher, a poet who is just returning from Canada to live in Dublin. Alvy grew up in Galway and Tipperary and has also lived in Louisiana and in South Korea. Spoke to her on the show in 2016 when she published her first book, Falling in Love with Broken Things. Her second collection, The Men I Keep Under My Bed, was published and came out in 2021. These new poems in What Remains the Same are works of trauma and resilience in which family and childhood have an important presence. Delighted that Alvy Carraher is with me in studio this evening. Just back from Canada, you've been kind of travelling for a while, I think, at this stage. Alvy, tell me about how that has fed into what you're doing in terms of the poetry, do you think, that travel?
Yeah, I think the travel, I mean, more than anything, it will give you perspective. I think you get a far away from who you are and makes you see the country differently and your family differently, and you're not so worried about what everybody thinks, I guess. But also there's age, like 8 years is a big difference. So
yeah, you get older. As you move along, you kind of say, well, I'm going to say these things now that maybe I didn't say before. Because I remember when we were speaking about Falling in Love with Broken Things, there was a lot of real happiness in it right throughout the book. Now, there was kind of underlying things there as well. But when I started to read What Remains the Same, from the outset, I thought, oh, there's a much darker undertow here. And it kind of comes more and more to the surface as the book goes on. Was that how the writing process was for you?
Yeah, I suppose it just sort of is, you say what you're able to say when you can say it. And then there's all those layers underneath that you might have taken out. I would have taken out poems before.
And why would you have done that before?
I would have been asked to, or I might have worried kind of that I would upset somebody or that I would get in trouble. But I think
was that mostly family members?
Yeah, it would have all been family. And I think you have a feeling that you need to protect them. But then I suppose you end up sort of hurting only yourself in the end, because you feel that you're silencing yourself, which isn't the best way to go with poetry.
Well, certainly you're going to have to salve that hurt at some point along the way.
Yeah.
Let's hear the title poem. You might give us a little lead into this, because I think it's important to know the fairy tale behind this, isn't it, in some ways?
Yeah, it's a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale. When I read it when I was younger, I just loved the story. I thought I would do the story in a poem form, and I was looking at all the different versions and getting very upset, I suppose, about which version I was going to tell.
Yeah.
And then I realised there was sort of a core to all of them. And it was only after I wrote the poem I realised that core of the poem was so close to my own story and my mother's story and the story of many people that sort of keep silent about things. But I only saw that later, so that's why it's in the collection. So What Remains the Same? It doesn't matter which version you've heard, whether they become swans or squat pigeons. Flip a coin. Let's say six or seven brothers. Give them any old feathers, eyes that glint. Count the years since their mother passed. Place each name on their sister's feverish lips. Details are immaterial. Ornaments hung on the narrow branch of story. Let them fall. What remains is a sister alone trying to break her brother's curse, stitching garments from thick nettles that break and blister her skin. She must swallow pain, remain silent. This is the shape of her life. What love, what duty compels her? If we forget for a moment the brothers, if we look at her red eyes, her set mouth, if we take her ruined hands in ours, if we press an ear to her silence, can we forgive ourselves this story?
Alvy Carraher with the title poem from her new collection, What Remains the Same. And what's notable in many ways in that, Alvy, is this constant references to keeping silent and staying silent, and the sister in that story who has to stay silent. You were saying that you felt it relates to your own story and your mother's story. In what way does it do that for you?
I mean, I suppose in many ways, we both would have been silent for a lot of our lives about what would have happened to us. And I mean, she still would be to protect other people or for men in the family. Yeah. And kind of protecting their reputation despite maybe things that they were doing. So I suppose that's that's the reflection that I see, but I suppose it's sort of wide open to interpretation.
Yeah. You're mentioning that the kind of things that you have been keeping quiet about and that your mother potentially keeps quiet about it as well. How difficult was when you had the time to stand back and really look at your growing up? How difficult was that period and how important was it to write about it?
It was important. I mean, I think I had a nervous breakdown in a courtroom. So after that, it seemed inevitable that I would have to write about it because it was obviously something that I was just sort of trying to control or keep down. And I think that happens a lot with people that have a lot of child abuse in their background. And I think, you know, people think they can't say that they were abused as a child unless it meets a certain criteria. But the fact is that there's a lot of it. Or there was a lot of it in the country. And when you start talking about it, you realise just how common and how important it is to write about how normal it is and every day, and it really shouldn't be.
The other thing that you do in the book in the new collection on a couple of occasions is that you start thinking about or dreaming about in some ways the type of house that you would like to be in and that you would like to be growing up in. I guess that's precisely what is there in the dream house itself, that poem. Will you read that poem for us?
Yeah, the dream house. When I went to my mother for help, she said there was a way to hold on, no matter what he said or did. You go inside, she said, deep down to the dream house. Focus on something small, a fingernail, a scar, a freckle. Let it blur until the front door begins to materialise. A brass knob, a knocker, a letterbox. Wait for it to feel solid, then enter. You had to go layer by intricate layer. Every inch mattered, details were important, the exact colour of a teapot, the curtains. You had to build each room as if it were real, as if you could press your hands to the windows. I focused on the crease between his eyes. He stormed and I footstepped closer. He raged and I slipped through the door. He could not see where I had gone, only that I was no longer with him. When I was in that house, with its thick carpets and sunshine walls, my mother, my sisters, my brother, all safe. Once I was there, I'd run through the rooms to make sure he wasn't hiding anywhere.
Albi Carraher with her poem, The Dream House, from her new collection, What Remains the Same. I was struck by how you went around this dream house, or the poet or whoever the character in the poem goes around the dream house, making sure that everything is safe for everybody else in the family. Did you have a sense of that type of responsibility growing up?
Well, I was the oldest of four in the first family. So, yeah, I mean, my parents had me at, my mother was pregnant at 19, and then my sister's only a year younger. So she had, I mean, I can't even imagine it. By the time she was my age, she had four kids. And I suppose I would have helped a lot from a very young age without realizing that was what I was doing. Until when I look back at it and I see like a 7 or 8 year old now, I realize how small they are to have so much responsibility. But at the time, I just felt like a little mother. Like,
yeah, that you were, you're kind of almost in loco. You were doing in loco parentis in some ways yourself. You. I remember that there was a poem that you had quite earlier on about sexual assault. And I think when you published that poem, you got dogs abuse in terms of trolling and all sorts of stuff that was thrown at you. How difficult, given that experience, was to write something as upfront and personal as this collection?
I think this is worse, or this is harder to write. I always wondered why people would say that was brave, because for me, those people were almost strangers to me. But with this, it's your family. So it's like breaking your own heart and doing it. And in another way, healing your own heart. Like, I don't know. I don't think I wouldn't encourage someone to do or not to do it. You just have to kind of do what's for you, because,
as you say, you say what you can say when you can say
it. Yes, exactly.
The book ends on a real note of hope. And there's a beautiful poem in there about library and how your mother brought you to a library and how books were a kind of opened up a whole new world to you. But the one that I want you to finish with is Note to Self. Is it the second last poem, I think, in fact? Well, maybe not even quite. Maybe it's a bit before that. But anyway, Note to Self. We want to get the full title of it. Note to Self on the... When the crisis is over, is that the full title?
Yeah, for when the crisis is
for
over.
When the crisis. Note to Self, for when the crisis is over. This ends on a real note of hope and security. So can we hear that?
Yeah. Note to self for when the crisis is over. Do not let me worry the days into blunt ends. None of it can be corralled into neat lists or spreadsheets counting targets, budgets, words. Here are the blank squares of my old plans. Look how easily it all fell apart, leaving only time, only me, only him. When it all gets busy again, may I give myself time to do the easy things well, like lying quietly in the mornings listening to the faint sound of his breathing in and out. How lovely it is to close my eyes and touch his body soft with sleep in our bed.
That's Alvy Carrer with a poem, Note to Self for When the Crisis is Over. The writing of the book, do you have a sense of some kind of, to use that term, completion? Is there a sense of having achieved something on a very personal level with this one, Alvy, that isn't there perhaps in other poems and collections?
Yeah, I think it's the book I would have dreamed when I was younger that I would have been able to write. And I sort of feel amazed when I look at it, because I don't know where some of the poems came from. And I can only trust that if I keep sitting down, more will come. But yeah, I only got the book a few weeks ago. Peter Fallon, the editor at the press, sent it over in the post. He had a day to send it over and came, and it was a lovely moment.
Yeah, well, congratulations on it. The dream boat book, I suppose it is, a bit like the dream house of the poem that you read for us earlier. That's Alvy Carrer, that new collection, What Remains Silent, What Remains the Same, is published by Gallery Press. And by the way, if there are any topics that may have been upsetting for people or triggering for people, you can always check rte.ie for a list of organisations where help can be found on those particular topics. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice and Leah Murphy were the researchers. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator this evening, and James Feeney was on sound. The programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. I will be back with you tomorrow night here on RT Radio 1 at 7 o'clock, and Fíochna O'Brien on will be with you after the news.